Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another great episode of Suspense Radio in honor of the new Skyfall movie, James Bond, coming out. We had to have Carly Simon telling us that nobody does it better. And I want to thank you all for joining us whenever you listen, wherever you listen. I'm your host, John Robb. Today's show is going to be fantastic. First, we're going to have best-selling author John Connolly coming up to talk about his adventures that he's going on in the world of literary. Then we got Sandra Parshall. And then Sam Hawkins to finish out the show. So sit back, relax, because the Halloween edition almost of Suspense Radio for 90 minutes is coming up right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
Again, everybody, like I said, this is going to be our final show for the end of the month. We'll be back on November, and we would love nothing more, of course. The first time we've had him on the radio show, he's been in the magazine, he's going to be in the magazine again. We're having him for November, and Mr. John Connolly, author of the best-selling Charlie Parker novels, welcome so much to the show, John. How are you doing today?
It's a pleasure to be here, John. Thank you very much. Doing good.
Yeah. Yes, and so you've been world-winning the tour. You're doing BoucherCon, the whole nine yards, over here from Ireland into the States with Wrath of Angels, which is out in the UK, will be out here in the US in January. So tell everybody a little bit about Charlie, what he's been doing, 11th novel in Wrath of Angels.
Well, it's getting on to the second decade of Charlie Parker books, I suppose. And one of the difficulties, I think, when you're a writer doing a series is that you it's very easy to repeat yourself. The tendency is to kind of find a pattern with them and to kind of keep going. And I think quite a long way back, probably around the third book, The Killing Kind, I thought that I wanted to try and avoid that with the Parker books. And part of doing that was to have a kind of larger story going on in the background, so that while you could read each book individually, if you read them in order, you got to see that there was a bigger plot unraveling. And so some of the books are more deeply involved in that plot than others. And I suppose The Wrath of Angels is one of those books. It's about the discovery of a plane in the Great North Woods that has no passengers left on it, but has never been recorded missing, and it doesn't appear to have a flight number. And it's based on something that really happened. Planes do go down in the Great North Woods in the great days before little GPS transponders. There are wrecks in there that haven't been found. It's a huge chunk of wilderness. And so it's a group of people, and more than people, hunting for whatever this plane may contain. And Parker gets drawn into the search for this wreck. So yeah, it's a big spooky one. Sometimes the books tend to be more human in the evil that they approach. I think The Burning Soul, the last book, was a very kind of intimate, almost a traditional mystery. We're as close to a traditional mystery I've ever done, or a traditional whodunit. And this is very different. This is a big blending of thriller and supernatural, I suppose.
Now, when you're devising, like, and you're starting to work on the 12th Charlie Parker novel, and you did, like, 11 here, Wrath of Angels, how much, you know, kind of pulling and tugging do you have to pull in your own mind to say, like you said, in the Burning Soul was more of a mystery, and now you kind of went the opposite way? What's kind of like your thought process you go through where you're trying to keep Charlie Parker, you're creating this entire whole world, like you said, with the backstory and then the main plot going forward? Do you have a lot of tugging and pulling within your mind while you're creating all that?
Not usually. I think for most writers, certainly most series writers, but I think for a lot of novelists, each book that you write tends to be a reaction to the one that went before it. So in terms of my own stuff, if I do a book that's quite intimate and insular and maybe a kind of quieter or subtler book, often for the next book, you tend to let yourself go a little bit more. You'll tend to do something that maybe is a bit bigger and brasher, because you've already, you know, it would be very hard to do two books that have a similar feel to them back to back. I think that would be difficult and hard to maintain your enthusiasm for, I think. So I think most we tend to react. And, you know, quite often I will begin with, I'm not a plotter. In the sense that I don't lay out a book in advance and then kind of work through it. I tend to know what a book will begin with. So I tend to know the opening of a book, and that's all I'll ever really start with. And so the Wrath of Angels begins with a man on his deathbed describing to his children how he and his friend once discovered this plane in the woods. And that's all I have when I begin. And because I write quite slowly at the start, certainly my first draft takes a long time, you know, by the time I've done that day's work, when I get up the following morning, I'll know what the next 1,000 or 1,500 words will be. And that tends to be the process for a chunk of the book until you're kind of two-thirds of the way through. About two-thirds of the way through, you pretty much know where you're going. And then you get a rush of speed towards the end as you near the climax. But I don't think that's untypical for writers who take that approach. I mean, there are some writers who are much more disciplined. Someone like Jeff Deaver, for example, who's very much very keen on laying out a book before he starts, will do a very intricate design for the book. I don't tend to be like that. I tend to veer slightly closer to the James Lee Burke school, where the book is in there somewhere, and part of the pleasure of writing it is discovering it as you go along.
Yeah, that and those are the ones, and you definitely have different schools of thought. And when you go, like when people attend like Thriller Fest and they attend Craft Fest and BoucherCon, and they see and they hear the panels, those are the kinds of things that they see and they hear, you know, from the different authors when you guys are explaining it. And I think that the biggest thing that new authors have to realize is that you have to find your voice and what works for you. And just because, you know, John Conley does it this way and Jeffrey Deaver does it this way doesn't necessarily mean it's right or wrong or whatever, but they just have to try to find their own voice. And that's kind of the thing that you're trying to tell
people. That's probably true. I think, but that comes from a process of trial and error. I think one of the things that's happened in recent years is, I suppose, this growth in writing classes or in writing workshops and in how-to books about writing. And those books tend to demarcate. They tend to be very keen on offering people rules and saying, this is the way to do it. But most writers, certainly my generation and preceding generations, we learned how to write by reading. It was a process of osmosis. And we didn't read with necessarily looking at these things as textbooks and thinking this is how we're going to write. We read for pleasure. All writers are readers first. And then gradually what happens is if you read good writing, you absorb the rules of good writing, but you absorb them instinctively. And you begin then to find a basis for what you want to do and what you're comfortable with. But a lot of the mechanics or methods that work for you come out of writing, of the process of writing. So I'm kind of distrustful of people who kind of lay it out from the beginning. It's almost counterintuitive in a way. You have to write before you can figure out how to write. In other words, you have to kind of get into the weeds of it before you figure out what works for you and what doesn't work for you. And that process of trial and error is interesting. But, you know, it will be different for every writer. Every writer will find himself or herself a place on that scale that works for them, whether you want to be a very intricate plotter, whether you want to be very methodical, or whether you don't want to do that at all and want to kind of take it on the lamb, as it were, and see how it works out. And everybody is a kind of some combination of the two. You know, we have to plan to a degree. You know, you have to have some vague notion of where you're going, or else, you know, the books will just ramble. But at the same time, all that matters is that at the end you produce a book, and that it's a book that can be read and enjoyed.
And we're speaking here with author John Connolly, and his latest book is The Wrath of Angels, the 11th in the Charlie Parker novel series. JohnConnollyBooks.com is his website. And the one thing that, and the other thing that you're also involved with is an anthology called Books to Die For, where you edit it with Declan Burke. And what it basically is you asked 120 of the world's top crime writers to recommend one book that fans should read. Now, that was a labor of love. How did you kind of get involved with that?
A lot of it came out of Declan had approached me after The Burning Soul had come out and asked me, was it something that I might be interested in doing? And to be honest, I was very reluctant to get involved with it. I suspected it was going to be an awful lot of work. And I was right.
And it was.
Except it was much more work than I thought it was going to be. You know, as you say, it was a labor of love. I think the thinking behind it was that often when people go into bookstores, now bookstores are front-loaded with the new. You know, that's what you get steered towards because that's what you see coming into the store. And if you're a reader, particularly if you're a mystery reader, where there's so much stuff coming out by so many writers, it can be hard just to keep up with the writers that you like who are still publishing. And I've reached an age where I'm very conscious of the gaps in my knowledge in terms of music and film and books. And I'm often going back now to fill in those gaps. I'm conscious of these gaping holes. And it can be quite difficult once you hit that stage to know where to start. I mean, I'm quite comfortable with it in a lot of literature and a certain amount of mystery fiction because I know my way around it. But if I was a kind of neophyte reader or somebody who hadn't delved very deeply into the background of it, I'd be a bit lost. You know, if you go into a mystery bookstore, if you've never been in a mystery bookstore before, your instinct would, you know, where do you start? What do you pick
up
first? When I go into the science fiction or fantasy sections of a bookstore, I tend to just do a U-turn and come out because I'm so lost in there that even the idea of trying to start is very difficult. And so it seemed that a good way to approach this would be to talk to writers rather than me sitting down or Declan sitting down and between us coming up with a list of 120 books, would be to approach writers and approach the best of writers, I mean the real cream, and say to them, look, if you were sitting down with somebody and the talk conversation turned to books, what would be the one book that if they said they hadn't read it, you would tell them to stay where they are and you would leave the pub or wherever you were and you would find a bookstore and you would buy it just so you could give it to them? Because I think we all have a couple of books like that. They are books that if somebody says, oh, I haven't read it, you'll actually send it to the person. You'll buy it and send it to them in the hope that they'll read it. And all writers, because writers are the products of the people that they read, in terms of mystery fiction, the writers that people loved are often the writers that formed them. So that when a writer writes about a book or a writer that he or she loves, they are writing about themselves in a way. So there's a very interesting relationship between writers, particularly established writers, and the books that they encountered along the way. So, you know, if you like Michael Connelly, it's very interesting to read Michael Connelly on Raymond Chandler because, you know, Connelly is very much a product of reading and indeed watching on film Chandler and adaptations of Chandler. You know, if Jeff Deaver, when we asked Jeff Deaver to do it, it seemed like he'd been waiting all his life to write 4,500 words on John D. MacDonald's The Executioners. You know, it was a book that meant something to him. And quite often that was what came about. The phrase we used was passionate advocacy. We didn't want people to necessarily pick a book that felt like homework. You know, because there are books that people feel you should read, but only because it seems like you're a lesser person if you don't, and you kind of get them out of the way and then you never have to go back to them again. But books that you have a passion for, that's very different from just admiration or, you know, a kind of technical appreciation for them. So we very much wanted writers to pick books that had really impacted upon them in a way. And when you do that, you tend to get interesting essays because, you know, to ask somebody to write about something that they love is not a huge imposition. And so a lot of interesting essays came out of it. Some of them critical essays, some of them slightly more personal because there were writers along the way who had met some of their idols, or who had met the people who had set them on a certain path. There's a lovely essay by the Canadian writer Linwood Barclay about writing a fan letter to Ross MacDonald. You know, and MacDonald at the time would have been certainly the greatest living crime novelist. I don't think there would be any opposition. And, you know, Linwood Barclay's a teenage boy who happens to like mystery novels. And a correspondence arises between the two of them. And then MacDonald is coming up to Canada, and he sends a note to Linwood Barclay saying, well, would you like to come to dinner? And, you know, out of that came then a personal encounter with a writer he admired. But not just that, MacDonald agreed to look at a manuscript for him. And so I don't know whether the manuscript was ever published, you know. Barclay was still a young man when he was writing it. But it's hard to believe that Barclay would be on the path he's on now had that meeting not occurred. And something similar happens with Joseph Wambaugh, who's one of the oldest contributors to the book, you know, struggling to write The Onion Field, you know, which is a book about a person he's seen in the LAPD, this man who in a course of an altercation with criminals handed over his gun to one of the criminals and watched his own partner being shot with it and became a pariah in the department. You know, there's Joseph Wambaugh, a young novelist, wondering how do you take a real occurrence like that and turn it into fiction or turn it into a form of fiction, and suddenly finding himself in the same room as Truman Capote, you know, the man who created the nonfiction novel Within Cold Blood. So there are those moments throughout the book where sometimes two generations of writers come together, or the right book finds its hands into the right writer at the right time. So a lot of the loveliest essays in it are very personal. You know, they're not just somebody saying, and on page 342, there's a lovely use of adverbs. You know, it's a much more about a kind of a passionate connection between a writer and a book.
Well, now, for your own personal feelings, besides a character, you know, besides Charlie Parker, a character, is there a character in literature that you have to maybe keep reading because they're just so, they're just so interesting that, you know, that you find that that's the one that you just have to keep following?
Well, I've got a couple like that, but the big one for me, certainly of writers who are still writing, and in the genre, would be James Lee Burke's Dave Robichaud. I mean, Burke was a huge influence on me as a young writer. I remember picking up Black Cherry Blues in a library and taking it home and being conscious that I hadn't read anything quite like that before. I hadn't read any mystery novel where the prose was so beautiful, I think, and where the prose served the story. It wasn't just beautiful writing for the sake of beautiful writing. There was a perfect blend between prose and plotting and characterization that I just loved. And so Robichaud's a big one for me. And I think, you know, Burke is the great poet of landscape in mystery fiction. Landscape and setting are so important in the mystery novel. But Burke has a way of writing about the natural world, which is just so, not just so beautiful, but it kind of creates a resonance with the rest of the books. And I think it's probably why I like the Robichaud books is because of Louisiana. Because I think if you get the setting right for your book, you do achieve a kind of resonance. And I think Burke's books are often about corruption. I think they're about the corruption of not just of institutions and of individuals, but of the human soul. And I think it's those books work because they are set against a natural world which is always in the process of corruption and growth. You know, if you've been to Louisiana, especially in the summer, this sense of just everything sweating, everything kind of the heat being so great that stuff begins to decay and it falls into these swamps and these bayous, and in turn it provokes new growth, so there's new growth growing out of the old. So that kind of setting seems so attuned to what he's doing. You know, I don't think it was any accident that he decided that, you know, he was going to write there, because obviously he's written about parts of Texas and about Montana too. But I think you feel that his heart probably, or certainly his soul, is probably with the Louisiana books.
And again, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with bestselling author John Connolly. His latest Charlie Parker novel is The Wrath of Angels, due out in the United States in January, available in the UK, and also Books to Die For, which is available now, which is where John and Declan Burke asked 120 authors their favorite mystery fans, their favorite books of all time that fans should read. Now, the other thing, when people go to your website, johnconnollybooks.com, and they sign up for your newsletter, now I get about 150 from different authors, but you are in the top five of when you send out your newsletters of the amount of information and what you give to the reader. Was that something that you consciously decided that you were going to be as open and as possible as you can by reaching out to the fans?
Well, I suppose so. I don't think there's any point in doing these things half-heartedly. You know, you may
right.
as well
but
embrace
some,
it.
But some people do, and that's the sad part.
Yeah, you know, well, it's a difficult thing. You know, for a long time, writers weren't expected to have a great engagement with readers. You know, we lived alone and worked in little rooms because we didn't play well with other children. And, you know, a lot of writers, you know, their personalities are perfectly attuned to that. You know, they would rather the kind of solitude of it. But increasingly, I suppose, part and parcel of what you do as a writer is engage with readers. And I just happen to quite like it. I don't find it an imposition. I find it's interesting to engage with people about books and writing or music or whatever else crops up in the newsletters. So I think maybe I'm just fortunate that in terms of my personality, I'm reasonably suited to it. But I feel a bit sorry for writers who are perhaps being pushed increasingly towards engaging in social media or, you know, doing a lot of personal appearances when, you know, they'd really rather not be doing it. That's not part of their personality. And you could argue they shouldn't have to do it. You know, if it's not something you really desire to do, then maybe you shouldn't really be made to do it. But I think the expectation is there that you're going to go out, that you're going to, you know, you're going to go on panels at BershaCon, you should be on Twitter, you should be on Facebook. And you know, increasingly that has skewed readers' perceptions of what the relationship with the writer should be. So, like I said, I quite enjoy it. I do feel a bit sorry, and I do understand those writers who don't want to do it. And, you know, there are times when I don't want to do it. There are times when if you're writing and trying to write a book, it's actually not good to be stepping out of the world of the book. It's not good to be distracted by you know, how whatever your people on Facebook have left messages about or be looking at Twitter or doing so much other stuff. Writing a book should be as immersive as reading a book, really. So it's about achieving a balance, I suppose.
And for a lot of fans who might not know you, you're not American. You're Irish, and if they can understand from your language. But the one thing that I've always been curious about and kind of why I was kind of prefacing this question, too, is there a difference between, you know, UK fans and writers, between American fans and writers? Do you see a contrasting difference between what each, you know, might like, the questions that you get, the importance of what's important to a UK fan might not be important as a, you know, United States fan? Do you see that? Because you do, you know, see both sides all the time with every one of your books because you come over here, and of course you're in Ireland and you're in the UK and you're promoting, so you get a chance to see them. Is there a big difference?
No, not so much an approach, I think, and people are reading the same books and getting the same things out of them. I think, you know, that I would get asked to dedicate books more often elsewhere in the world than in the US. I think that collecting book, that notion that we buy a book and we have it signed and we keep it on our shelves, it has taken hold much more in the US, and has always taken hold much more in the US in terms of mystery than it does in Ireland and the UK, where people will always, nearly always ask you to sign a book to them. In the US, that it's probably more 50-50, where people are holding on to it to collect. As an investment, I always think that when I sign a book, so secretly the person's hoping my plane goes down the next day, you know, so they can go, yes, this was the last one he ever signed. You know, look, it's dated. Eventually people will be getting me to date it and put the time on it just so they can say, yes, there it was.
Right.
An hour later, he was no longer with us. It's very sad. That would be $500, you know. So I think that's the only difference, that in terms of collecting and in terms of having maybe a more developed community of mystery readers, the U.S. is probably a little further ahead.
Now, we only got a couple minutes left here, so, you know, the burning question, of course, is always wondering, you know, what's coming up in the future, because you still have, you know, the Gates and the Infernals and that series going on, of course, with Charlie Parker going on. Is there going to maybe be a standalone, or are you going to throw Charlie into just some more crap because the poor guy hasn't been through enough in 11 books already? What can we expect from John Colley here coming up, you know, in the 2013 and beyond? What do you got going on?
Well, Well,
assuming you don't die in that plane crash.
Assuming I don't die in that plane crash, which I'm rather hoping I don't. There will be another Parker book in 2014, but I haven't started writing it yet. I've spent this year, the second half of this year, kind of experimenting with things. I've done a little bit of the next Samuel Johnson book because I enjoy doing those little odd little science books for kids. I've written with my other half. I've been experimenting with a piece of science fiction because that's a genre that I didn't know a great deal about and was anxious to explore. And I wrote a novella, an odd novella about a book collector. And none of those things is to contract. They are things that I wanted to explore because it was useful for me to explore them and it was good for me as a writer to explore them. So they may never appear. If they do, great. If my publishers want them, great. But if not, they were things that were worth doing. What is good for you commercially is not always good for you creatively and vice versa. And sometimes you need to take a little bit of time out and stretch your muscles a little bit. So it means that when I return to the Parker books, I am enthused. I know it's what I want to do. And so when I've got this other stuff finished, I'm very, very much looking forward to starting to write the next Parker book. But it won't appear until 2014, which won't make any difference to Americans. You know, you're not getting The Wrath of Angels until January 2013. And I would anticipate the next Parker book will be February or March 2014. So U.S. people won't really notice it. People in Britain and Ireland may notice it a bit more.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, if your publisher doesn't want to publish, like, one of your science fiction, you let me know, and my publishing company will definitely want to take a look at it, and maybe we can do something, because I just said I would have to find that actually pretty astronomically ridiculous if they didn't want to look at something like that. So, but, John, I want to thank you so much for coming out. I mean, it's always a pleasure. We can go on for hours just talking, because there's so many other things that we could have gotten into, but you know what? I know you're very busy and you got a lot of stuff to do, and we just want to thank you for taking just this short amount of time to come on and talk with us, and hopefully we will see you at Thriller Fest next year, and then I don't think I'm going to go to Albany and VoucherCon. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to torture myself there, but definitely in Long Beach in a couple of years maybe, but if you're ever out in L.A., you drop us a line and let us know. We can get together.
I shall indeed, John. Thank you very much for the interest and your time. Much appreciated.
Yes. Thank you so much, John. You enjoy yourself and have fun.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that was best-selling author John Connolly, his website, johnconnollybooks.com. If you don't know about it, then you've been lying under a rock, and his book is The Wrath of Angels, coming out in January 2013, the 11th Charlie Parker novel, and also the book that he put together with Declan Burke in Books to Die For, where 120 of the world's top crime writers were asked to recommend one book to mystery fans, another book to check out, because I'm sure there's books in there that you have not read that you should read. We're going to take a quick break, but the one thing that I do want to announce before our next guest comes on is there was something in there that I asked John, and it will be a trivia question, because John is going to sign a copy of The Wrath of Angels for a listener to the show, and I'm going to go ahead and send that out on Facebook, that question, in about a week to let people kind of listen to the show and get things going on. And all you have to simply do is just email us your answer, because if you put it on Facebook, and you're right, everybody's going to know. You just kind of email us your answer, we're going to do a drawing, and you will be mailed out a copy. One person will be mailed out a copy of John Connolly's The Wrath of Angels autograph. So that's something that we're going to start, you know, kind of trying to do new here. Tasha Alexander was going to be on the show today, and she had to bump herself, but she's going to do it when she comes on the show later in November. So we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with our next guest, author Sandra Parshall, for her book called Bleeding Through, and it is her character's fifth adventure, and she is going to tell us all about this, and we're going to get into it. So in the meantime, sit back, relax, and enjoy this, and we'll be right back with you.
She
everybody here. We want to again thank John Connolly for being on the show to talk about his latest Charlie Parker book, The Wrath of Angels, and that's johnconnollybooks.com. Check everything out. Like I said, his newsletter is probably one of the top five best newsletters you could subscribe to find out everything about John. We are jumping in here now with our next guest. Her name is Sandra Parshall, and her website is sandraparshall.com, P-A-R-S-H-A-L-L. And her book is called Bleeding Through. It's the fifth book in her Rachel Goddard series. And Sandra, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you for inviting me.
So again, Bleeding Through, book five. You got a series going on with your character, Rachel Goddard. Can you tell us a little about, you know, about Bleeding Through, maybe the progression coming up from books one to four and now into book five, and how Rachel's kind of progressed through the series for fans who are just finding you out?
Okay. I want to say, first of all, you can read Bleeding Through without having read the others, but of course I want you to read the others.
Of course.
When I started the series, Rachel was living in McLean, Virginia, which is where I live. The first book was The Heat of the Moon, and I didn't really think it was going to be the start of a series. I thought it was a standalone suspense novel. And in that book, she was trying to learn the truth about her family's background and getting stonewalled by her very controlling, manipulative psychologist mother. And from when I learned that the publisher did want a series, I moved her out of McLean. I moved her out to the mountains of southwestern Virginia to start over. After all the terrible things I did to her in the first book, she needed to start over someplace quieter. And since then, she has been living sort of a semi-outsider in this mountain community and getting involved in local murders and crimes at the same time that she is working through a lot of the damage that was done to her in the first book psychologically. And Bleeding Through really harks back to that first book. And I do resolve some of the issues that were left a little tentative at the end of that first book, especially her relationship with her sister, who has not appeared again until now. And now she has come back into Rachel's life because she is being stalked, and she's terrified. And the police where she lives in Maryland will not believe her. Her own husband doesn't believe that this is happening. He thinks that she's imagining things. But she knows that Rachel will take her seriously. So she shows up at Rachel's doorstep at the house where Rachel is living with the sheriff's deputy, Tom Bridger. And they're on the verge of getting married. At least Tom thinks they are. Rachel's not so sure. But anyway, she comes down to get Rachel's help and her protection as a big sister and her comfort during a difficult time. She's hoping that the stalker will not follow her. However, it soon becomes evident that he has followed Michelle. And now he's turning his attention to Rachel, too. He's tormenting both of them. At the same time, Tom Bridger is working on the local murder case of a young law student, a female law student, who has turned up dead locally, even though she disappeared hundreds of miles away in Northern Virginia from her college campus. And she was working on an innocence project case, trying to get a local man out of prison. She believed that he was wrongly convicted for murder. So while Tom works on the murder case, Rachel is trying to protect her sister and herself from the stalker. And people who have read my books know that eventually there will be connections between these two cases, but that's all I'm going to say. But you can read it without having read the earlier books, but I hope that you will read the earlier books, especially the first one. And right now it couldn't be easier because it's available as a free download from Amazon for everybody who has a Kindle.
Oh.
Yeah, it's The Heat of the Moon, and you can get it for free.
So, and that's the start of the Rachel Goddard series, The Heat of the Moon.
Yes.
And then you kind of bring her going through all the way up. Now, when you were developing her, is this what you envisioned when you started writing this character? Did she kind of change direction on you while you were kind of going through? How kind of was the dynamic between you and your character, Rachel, as you progress now through these five books?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I love Rachel, but she is difficult. She is not an easy character to write, and I like writing Tom Bridger's viewpoint because he's more or less predictable. You know, he's very solidly grounded. Rachel has some psychological issues that hold her back, you know, from fully committing to things and fully committing to people emotionally. And it's a little hard to write her sometimes, but through every book, she is working through more and more of this. And I don't want to make it sound as if the books are burdened with this heavy emotional storyline, because they're not. It's just part of the story and a background part at that. But she is a wonderful, wonderful young woman, I think. She's very brave. She's courageous, especially in defense of other people, helpless animals. She's a veterinarian. She loves animals. She will do almost anything to protect an animal that's being abused. In my last book, called Under the Dog Star, she's trying to rescue a pack of feral dogs in the county that all the local farmers want to shoot because they're regarded as pests. And she knows that they are just pets that have been abandoned out in the country. You know, there are people who lose their jobs, they lose their homes, and they think that their dogs will be better off, dogs or cats will be better off if they just take them out in the country and turn them loose and fend for themselves. But animals that have been pets can't really do that. They're not equipped to fend for themselves. So they start attacking livestock and so on. And Rachel in Under the Dog Star sets out to rescue an entire pack of feral dogs. And that doesn't make her popular with the local farmers, but that's the kind of person she is. She will not stand by when she feels that some innocent creature or some innocent child is being mistreated, and that gets her into trouble, but she's willing to do it. She's because she has a strong moral sense. It's in protecting herself where she often fails. She puts herself in danger sometimes in defense of others.
Now, as you've been kind of going through this journey, because you started out with, you know, you're writing newspapers, you kind of mentioned on your site in your biography that you were writing newspapers, but you've always wanted to write, you know, you were writing fiction as a child, you just didn't really find the genre that you felt comfortable in, and now you've kind of falling in now into mystery and suspense, and that's kind of where you feel, your comfort zone. So was there kind of any advice, any authors you kind of leaned on while you were kind of maybe writing The Heat of the Moon or going forward that maybe helped you kind of through something that newer writers can maybe take from on your journey that you've been going through?
I'll tell you, when I was growing up, I may be the only female mystery writer in the world who has never read a single Nancy Drew book. So I did not grow up influenced by mysteries, and I didn't really start reading mysteries until my mid-20s. And I started by reading all of Agatha Christie, and you can imagine what a chore that was.
Yes,
and
it
is. Then I moved on to something completely different when I discovered Ruth Rendell. And she really has influenced me a lot because Rendell is just a master plotter, and she is fantastic in her ability to get inside the minds of her characters. And that is so admirable to me, the way she's this wonderful British lady, you know, very proper. I think she's 82 or something. And she can write from the viewpoint of the most incredibly slimy people. I don't know how she does it, but she is one of my models. And another one is Thomas H. Cook, because of his beautiful writing. And he's also has a great empathy with his characters. And I think from the two of them, very early on, before I even wrote a mystery, they taught me a lot about writing in general, is that what readers are looking for is an emotional connection with the characters. You can have the greatest plot in the world, but if readers don't care about your characters, if they can't understand them or see what makes them tick, then they're not going to be interested. The book will turn them off. It's just plot, you know. It has no depth if it doesn't have characters that you can connect with. And those two writers in particular taught me that. And I worship both of them. Whenever I see Thomas Cook at a mystery conference, I feel like getting down on my hands and knees, you know, and thanking him for all he's taught me unknowingly, just by reading him.
Well, you know, it was funny. You just brought up Agatha Christie, and when I was talking to John Connolly off the air before the show, Agatha Christie came up because I was on Netflix, and I started to watch some of those mystery masterpiece theaters. And so here's a question, because I was surprised kind of made with his answer, and he told me I was wrong with my answer, so we disagreed on it. Is it Hercule Poirot or is it Miss Jane Marple? Which character from Agatha Christie do you find more intriguing and like?
They're both
you got to pick one.
Well, they're both. I guess I preferred Poirot, but
that's what I said. Connolly thought it was Miss Jane Marple. He goes, "Well, obviously, John, you're wrong, but that's okay." And I go, "Wait a minute." So yeah, I was more of a Poirot, but I guess he thought that Miss Jane Marple was more. He likes her better. So I thought that was interesting. But why are, now when you say Poirot, is that something that you kind of think about while you're maybe writing your stories and things of that nature? Do you kind of remember the kind of wittiness, and I mean, he's kind of very arrogant and things like that. Do you think about those when you're kind of creating characters for your book or maybe moving Rachel forward and things like that?
I don't know what Poirot would make of any of my villains. I think he would be astonished by them. He's never encountered anybody like them. But I was going to say, and it's this will probably make me make some readers angry, but I think both Poirot and Marple are more symbols than people. They're neither one of them is very deeply developed. We don't learn a lot about them. You know, they are there to move the plot forward and to solve the mystery. And beyond that, I mean, really, how much do you know about either one of them? And do you see much of their personal lives in any of the books? They are really not, their personal lives are not part of the book. And I think today's mystery readers want to know as much about the main characters as they do about anybody else in the story. And it really, readers today who read a series, they read it to follow the development of the protagonist's personal life, I think, more than anything else. Yeah,
was that kind of like your basis for saying, I'm going to write a series and I'm going to write the Rachel Goddard book, because you wanted to not only explore plot lines and within the genre, but you maybe wanted to explore character development and keeping one going along and exploring that more with your writing instead of just always writing standalones?
Yeah, after The Heat of the Moon, I thought that, you know, if I could sell it, that it would probably be a standalone. But I was very happy to continue with that character because so much happened to her in that book, and it left a lot of questions in my mind. You know, I wanted her to go on and eventually be happy in life, but I knew that for somebody who had been through what she had been through, it was not going to be easy, and it was not going to be quick. And I've been very happy to go on that journey with her and watch how her life develops and how she moves toward a place where she can be happy, an emotional place where she can be happy, where she has somebody who loves her and will share her life. And, you know, that's what most people want out of life, is just to live, you know, with somebody who loves you and to be happy. And she didn't have that at the end of the first book, not really. So I've been very happy to continue writing about her and let her go through this process in the books.
And when you sit there and you're kind of, you know, creating this entire world along, you know, with this character, do you have in each one of your books, like, one particular maybe sentence or scene that maybe kind of captures the whole essence of the book and what you're trying to get out, that kind of brings it all together? It could be at the beginning, it could be at the end, it could be in the middle. But does bleeding through and all your books, do they kind of have that one particular scene in there that just kind of pulls the whole thing together, like the essence of it?
I think in Bleeding Through, there is a scene between Rachel and her sister near the end where Rachel thinks about they are talking about the past and their childhoods and what happened to them. Something truly horrific happened to them when they were children, and they have never really talked about it before. But in that scene, they do start to talk about it, and Rachel is thinking that this how painful this is to have the past bleeding through into the present and staining the present. And I think that, but it's something that she has to go through, and her sister has to go through it, or they won't come out the other end. And I think that summarizes the personal story in that. The murder story, the other plot line in the book, I think it's a story about the way murder affects a community, the way it affects several families, the way people take sides, the anger it creates, even after somebody is convicted and sent to prison. A murder in a small community is just horrifically upsetting to everybody. It upsets your normal life. It changes everything. And I think just there are a number of scenes in the book that bring that up, and I think that that's the real message of the murder story in that book, that, you know, murder changes everything. Murder changes a community. It can change a whole community.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you see that in real life just when things happen. I just saw a news story the other day where, of course, when we had that James Holmes, allegedly, I have to say, go into that movie theater in Denver and, you know, kill the lives of 12 people. And then all of a sudden, I guess Madonna just had a concert there, and there was a skit about her having a gun and shooting things into the crowd or whatnot, I guess, like whatever. I mean, that was just very, very poor, because that community has now been forever changed with Columbine and now with this. You know, you might get away with that in Los Angeles or New York, but there's just certain things that maybe you should have to think about and say, I should not do that in my concert here in this city, because that's just wrong, because it has changed them. So I totally agree with exactly what you're saying. And writing can do the same thing and bring that kind of emotion on somebody, because you never know who's going to read it. And it's going to affect people in different ways in different communities because of things that have happened in the real life. And then all of a sudden you write something without knowing, and it kind of hits home, and it kind of feeds an emotion to the reader that you never thought would happen.
Right. It can be both disturbing and rewarding. I had a woman who read The Heat of the Moon sent me an email saying that she wanted to thank me because after reading that book, she understood her relationship with her mother so much better than she ever had before. I was stunned. You know, I'd never met this woman, and I, well, you know, I'm glad if it had that effect. And I've had other people tell me that I changed their minds about things, or I made them think about things that they hadn't thought about before, and think of them in a new light. And I just, you know, in my books, I don't, I do have one or two villains who are just plain evil, you know, and they need to be eradicated from the face of the earth, I think. But usually I can see both sides. You know, I don't usually want the reader to completely hate my villains. I want them to understand them a little. At least a little, you know, enough to understand why they are behaving this way and to see that they're people too. You know, they had childhoods, they grew up in a family, they had experiences, and something has brought them to this point. And if you don't understand that, then, you know, all you're seeing is a cartoon, you know, a bad guy cartoon, and that's not what I want to present. I want people to see my villains as people, and with their own histories and their own reasons for what they're doing, because there is always a reason. And I want, you know, my heroes are not perfect either, and I want people to see that, you know, that you can be a hero in your everyday life without being perfect. You can do the right thing even if you're not perfect. You can do the right thing even if it comes at a cost and it's hard for you, but you can still do it because you know it's the right thing to do. So I love hearing from readers, and I'm always fascinated when they tell me that a book affected them in one way or another or made them feel one emotion or another. It's as if they're talking about somebody else, frankly, but I love hearing it. I really do.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, Sandra, we want to thank you, you know, so much for coming on, because, you know, I think fans can hear the passion and the kind of work and dedication that you are putting into, you know, your Rachel Goddard mystery series. You got book 5 here bleeding throughout your website, sandraparshall.com. So, you know, real quick, in about, you know, 30 seconds, do you have anything coming up in the future or places where people can find you? I know you have your events. You got some things coming up. I think today you're going to be out at a signing tonight, and then you have another interview coming up in November. So anything else that you have going on that people can maybe see you at?
Well, actually, my signing is on Monday night. My website, I'm afraid, has a mistake on it.
It's
Monday night, and it's at Tyson's Regional Library, which, thank heavens, is very close to my house.
Yeah.
And I have been doing a number of things over the past month, and this, I'm getting toward the end of my personal appearances, but I will be there at the Tyson's Regional Library on Monday night at 7 p.m., and I promise I'll get everybody out of there in time to get home and watch the debate.
I'd be sarcastic, because that's important to me.
Yeah.
I'd rather do 1,000 other things than have to watch, you know, hear the same thing over and over again from another debate.
But I am always blogging on Wednesdays at Poe's Deadly Daughters. That's my regular blog, and people can email me anytime with any questions. I love to hear from people.
Well, again, Sandra, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Again, sandraparshall.com. bleedingthrough.com is the website. The book is Bleeding Through, book 5 of your Rachel Goddard series. So thanks a lot for coming on, Sandra, and we will talk with you later.
Thank you. This was fun.
All right. Bye-bye. Enjoy yourself.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, the book is Bleeding Through, book 5 here in the Rachel Goddard series. SandraParshall.com is the website to go find out more information about. Go back and read books 1 through 4 to come up to book 5, or start with book 5, like Sandra said, and then you can kind of go back and, you know, go back to 1 through 4. In the meantime, we're going to take, again, another about 3-minute break. We're going to be back with our last and final guest here on the show, author Sam Hawken, to talk about his book, The Dead Women of Roez. I probably said that wrong again. I'm terrible at pronunciation. But hopefully Sam will let me know that I screwed that one up. So we will then be back on with that, and in the meantime, we will see you in about 3 minutes. Hold on. We are back, ladies and gentlemen, here with our final segment of the show. We've had a great time with John Connolly and Sandra Parshall already, and we are proud to bring on for the first time onto the show author Sam Hawken to talk about his book, The Dead Women of Juarez. And Sam, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I am doing fine, and thank you for having me.
And just so everybody knows, your website is samhawken.com. They can kind of go on there, check some things out that you have going on. But The Dead Women of Juarez, can you give us a little bit behind the scenes, little action stuff that's going on with the book, kind of tell everybody about it? And we just had a little bit of interesting talk off the air of maybe, you know, where it's, you know, where people can get it, because for some reason there's kind of like, you know, it's out in the U.S. or stuff like that, but kind of explain that a little bit too.
Yeah, well, I'll start off with where you can get it. Right now you can get it everywhere. It came out a couple of years ago in physical form in the U.K., but now it's had a U.S. release as of this month, so you can go in any bookstore and buy it. In fact, I saw it on my local bookstore just the other day. So it exists, and you can get it. And if you want to get an e-book, it is available for as an e-book. Yeah. The situation is a little more tricky with the next book that's coming out, but I probably want to talk about The Dead Women first before we talk about anything else. As far as The Dead Women goes, it is taking its inspiration from a real-world problem in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, which is a city in Mexico right across the border from El Paso, Texas. And starting in about the early to mid-90s, women started to disappear or be murdered. The murder rate for women actually went up 600% in 1994 and has continued on this path ever since. And the official numbers run somewhere between 500 and 1,000 dead women. And some people put the numbers at thousands and thousands, even as high as 5,000. So that's sort of the background of where everything takes place in the book.
I think a lot of people in the news realize have heard about, you know, all the drug cartel problems and things in Mexico, and probably have quite frankly scared to death to even go down there. Was that kind of the basis when everything started coming out that you said, hey, you know, this is something to explore? I see a book out of this.
Well, about 2008, Amnesty International USA did a public awareness campaign about the dead women. And I am kind of involved with them. And when that came out, I said, wow, that's shocking and also interesting, you know, in a perverse way.
Right.
And I thought, well, maybe I should write about that. And I didn't really know what to write, so it sat for about a year or so, and then I started working on it. And, of course, as I was working on it, the drug war absolutely exploded. That started around 2009 in earnest. And that sort of overshadowed the whole thing now, because the murder rate is insane in Ciudad Juarez, and I don't blame anyone for not wanting to go, but it's a slightly different issue from the feminicidios, as they are called, the murders of women.
You know, and were you down there? Did you go into Mexico? Did you kind of see the ins and outs of the stuff going on? Did you kind of do it from afar? How did you kind of get your research for this one?
Well, I am from Texas, and so I spent many years of my life going into and out of Mexico, and I am familiar with Ciudad Juarez, from having visited there multiple times. So I was able to write from that perspective. I have not been back since everything went to hell. And to be perfectly honest, I'm probably not going to go back until things settle down. Because even with the murder rate off by about 47% this year, they're still killing 5 to 6 people a day. So it's not somewhere you want to be. But as far as what's happening there now, I read a lot of Mexican media, and there are some really nice analysis blogs out there, people who do this for a living, and talking about various issues. So I'm able to get from that a lot of very interesting stuff, which I can then incorporate into my work.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the scary parts of it, is just the amount of violence that is going on and not really being cleaned up. And you've kind of put it in here, you know, the Dead Women of Juarez, and like you said, it was something that's now kind of gotten overshadowed by all the stuff that is going on. But within your characters, you know, Palmano, the young woman who kind of works in the group, and, you know, you kind of got her, you know, her boyfriend Kelly and things like that. How was the creation around the novel with an event that was going on? How were you kind of able to, you know, kind of put kind of all that together? What was the process for you like having to do all of that?
Well, the strange thing that I always tell people is that originally the book wasn't even going to be about the female homicides. I had an idea. I said, I'm going to write a book, a noir book, about a boxer. And so it's going to be boxing noir. It's going to be set in the Texas-Mexico border country, which I know very well. And I started working on it. And then I started thinking about why, and about this issue that I had been exposed to. And I said, well, maybe if this guy has some kind of connection to that, then maybe I could add some resonance to this book, and it's not just about a guy who gets beat up for money. And from there, Paloma was created as his girlfriend who's involved in the activism, because there are groups that are active in Ciudad Juarez, women's groups, that are involved in this issue even to this day. And it just sort of unfolded from there in terms of, I say, now, who's going to be interested in these murders? Well, there will be policemen interested, obviously. So what kind of policeman would be involved in the life of this broken-down character? Because the character of Kelly Corder in the book is he's a boxer, but he is a destroyed individual. He's a former drug addict. He basically gets paid to go into the ring with much younger, much more fit fighters and get beaten up.
Right.
For the entertainment of the audience. He's not a celebrity. He's not anybody special. He's this sort of rundown, next to worthless individual. And I said, well, who would be connected to that? And that's where I created the character of Rafael Sevilla, the policeman who also carries a significant chunk of the narrative. And I said, now, here's this guy. Why would he be interested in this guy? Well, he wouldn't be a super cop or anything of that nature. He too would be flawed and broken down in the same way. And so they're all these deeply flawed individuals, and they just sort of one rolled into the other, and then the story kind of grew out of that relationship.
And, you know, when people are going to kind of go onto your website, and again, we're talking here with author Sam Hawken and at samhawken.com, you know, they're going to notice, they're going to see The Dead Woman of Juarez, and then they're going to see the other book that you have, you know, Tequila Sunset. Are those
Yes.
the only two books that you have out for people to get? Because, you know, The Dead Woman of Juarez then would kind of be like your debut novel, and that's, you know, you're kind of doing something, you know, subject matter that for a debut, I mean, that's, you know, a very much of an undertaking.
Well, yeah, I didn't really think of it like that when I was working on it. I just wanted to do something that I thought was interesting and worthwhile. And as it happens, it's been really well received. I got really great reviews in the UK where it was released, and it was shortlisted for Crime Writers Association Dagger as well, which all these things kind of surprised me. People really latched on to the social significance of it. And it's not something that I said, I'm going to write a book that's really going to get people riled up about this issue. That wasn't something that I actually set out to do. I just wanted to talk about it. And I didn't think that I had done a really amazing job of doing it, but apparently people disagree. And that makes me happy, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, because the one thing that I find fascinating, and I also find kind of perplexing, I guess, is you're writing about Mexico, a North American area, you know, bordered with the United States, but then they released it in the UK first. What was with the publishers thinking of doing that? Was it something that was difficult for a United States publisher to get on with first, and UK just kind of jumped on it first? How is that kind of dynamic? Because it sounds like it's a made for, you know, North American rights first to get out, and the UK might not be that intrigued with it because, let's face it, they're not close to Mexico.
No, they're not. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you completely. Basically, what happened was...
Not many people do, and see, I like that. Not many people agree with me completely, so I'm happy when they do.
No, well, you're definitely onto something there in terms of it's much more relevant to us in the United States than it would be to people in other countries. At least you would think that.
Yeah, you would think if you're writing a novel about George Washington, they're not going to release it in Japan first.
Right, yeah. Well, what happened was, is I had written the book, and I had an agent who is based in Ireland, and I happened to pass the book off to a friend of mine named Dave Zeltzerman, who's another crime writer. And he read it, and he said, "This book is fantastic. I'm going to take it to the guys who just published my last book. They are a publisher in the UK called Serpent's Tale, and they're going to love it." So I said, "Sure, go ahead. That's fine with me." So he sent it to his editor. His editor went crazy for it, and they bought it. The amount of time elapsed was like a month. I mean, they jumped on it immediately.
Huh.
And they wanted to make it available in the U.S. right away. They said, "What we're going to do is we're going to publish it here in the U.K., but we're going to make the U.S. rights available, so if another publisher wants to take them on, they can publish the book in the U.S. But if nobody else takes it, then we'll do it ourselves eventually." And eventually is now here. But it's been, like I was telling you before we got on the air, it's been almost 2 years
right.
since it came out. So eventually it took a while.
Yeah, it just fascinates me to kind of see the thought process behind those things. And you must have been, like I said, you must have been surprised too, because what we also talked about and is the book Tequila Sunset kind of doing the same exact thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Tequila Sunset comes out on the 1st in the UK only, in the physical copy, and I'm actually holding a copy of the book in my hand as we speak.
Yeah.
And if you flip it over, the price on the back is in British pounds, and there's no American price anywhere on it. And the e-book will be available from day one in the U.S., but there'll be no physical book until such time as they have exhausted the possibilities of it going to another publisher picking up the rights and publishing it themselves. Because, I mean, they're a small house. They don't have a lot of money to be publishing all over the place. And that's kind of the burden you bear working with a smaller publisher. I mean, if they were Simon & Schuster or something like that, then there would be no problem. They could put it out everywhere.
Right.
Because they have millions and millions of dollars to do it. But, yeah, it is very strange because, like, The Dead Woman has come out in the U.K., and then it came out in Germany, and then last month it came out in France, and then it's only now in the United States where you would think that the primary audience would be. People say, "Ooh, Mexico, that sounds interesting. I will pick that up."
It's funny because you mentioned, you mentioned three territories, and none of them are even Spanish-speaking territories. Have you released Portugal or, Portugal or Spain or something, for crying out loud?
Spain.
The dynamics
is
funny.
Yeah, well, and the Germans, they went crazy for it, too, which kind of amazes me. Apparently, there's a very big audience
crazy
for
anything,
this kind of thing.
I think the Germans go crazy for anything that's written about another country negatively than their country. Because there's been so many bad books about Nazism with the Germans. And, I'm German, and so they're probably like, "Yeah, we're jumping all over something else that's not written bad about our country for once, damn it."
Yeah, that's entirely possible. But apparently there's a really big audience for crime fiction in Germany, which, of course, I had no idea.
Yeah, that in Scandinavia. That's huge, huge.
Yeah, so, I mean, we'll see if it comes out in any more countries, but it looks like it's going to be these four territories, and then that will be the end of its lifespan, which is a little sad, but I'm happy that it came out in the U.S. at all, because that wasn't a guarantee.
But you did say something that at least is good, because I don't know if you watched the news this week, but Newsweek magazine, which is a huge magazine, weekly magazine that comes out all over the place, is no longer in 2013 going to print their magazine. They're going to be 100% electronic coming up in 2013. So at least your next book, Tequila Sunset, is going to be available in ebook form, which, when you see something like that, you have to think that in 2 or 3 years, the ebook is going to be 100. I think it's going to be a 100% guarantee that that's going to be the number one area where people are going to have books. Now, there will always be hardcover, there will always be paperback. Don't want to piss anybody off, but ebooks are going to be the number one medium for people to buy books, so at least they can buy your book, Tequila Sunset. So kind of give us, what's going on with that one, because at least people in the U.S. can, pick that up through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever they have e-readers.
Right. Well, yes, and by all means, please do pick it up, not just because I make money, but because the more people who buy it, the bigger the push for it becomes, because when you start getting sales, then the publisher really gets behind it. I mean, that happened in the UK where they actually did a big bookstore push for The Dead Women when it started to hit big, and that helped sales quite a bit. And people were actually getting it and reading it, which to me is almost more important than the pay. It's nice to get paid, but I like the fact that people are actually getting it, reading it, and liking it. So, you know, and by all means, grab a copy of Tequila Sunset when that comes out. But as for what it's about, it is set in the exact same region, in the El Paso, Ciudad Juarez area, mostly in El Paso, but some takes place in Ciudad Juarez. And what it's about is the gang called Barrio Azteca, which started as a prison gang in Texas, but has sort of metastasized into a street gang and into El Paso and other areas in Texas, but nowhere else as big as in Ciudad Juarez, where they have linked up with the Juarez cartel. And at the time when I was writing the book, they were assumed or estimated to be responsible for about 85% of the deaths in the city.
Wow.
So these are extremely bloodthirsty individuals, and they'll kill people at the drop of a hat, set them on fire, you know, all kinds of really horrible stuff. And what I wanted to do was talk about that in that book and say, here's this gang that we created here in the U.S. that has gone completely berserk in another country. And we have some responsibility for that, and the people who get involved in the dismantling of at least one part of that organization. There's a cop from El Paso who's in the gang unit. There is a federal cop in Mexico. Ooh, geez, my voice is going. A federal cop in Mexico that is tasked with dealing with the Los Aztecas, as they call them over there. And then there's a member of the gang himself who's kind of caught between two worlds because he didn't really want to join, but when he was in prison, and in prison you do what you got to do to survive. And if that means joining a gang, then that's exactly what you do. So it's a little more complicated narrative than The Dead Women. The Dead Women is basically from two characters' point of views. This one's got three going on, and the story's all sort of intermixed.
And I want to remind everybody that we're talking here with author Sam Hawken, samhawken.com. Two books coming out here for the American public, The Dead Women of Juarez, which will be out in hardback form, and then Tequila Sunset, which is going to be out in ebook form over here in the United States, which is good news. So, Sam, so what kind of, you know, kind of off topic of books or so, but what kind of movies or TV shows, you know, are you interested in? What kind of things are like on your DVR right now? What kind of movie are you looking to get excited over if you've watched over the summer?
You know, I have very strange TV watching tastes, and they don't really relate very much.
Strange. We love strange here, man.
Well, it's like I really like this show called Face Off that's about movie makeup. It's a competition show where these people do movie makeups under extreme pressure on various themes, and then one person gets kicked off at the end of the show like they do in all these shows.
Right.
But, I mean, that's an odd show. The most people go, Face Off, what is that? Well, let me tell you, it's about they do alien makeups, and they, you know, that kind of stuff. And they go, what are you watching that for? Shouldn't you be watching crime shows? And for the most part, I don't watch crime shows.
Right.
I don't watch the police procedurals. I don't watch any of that stuff. I watch The Daily Show. I watch Colbert Report. You know, things like that. I watch cooking shows.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's the kind of stuff that interests me. I just, for whatever reason, I've never really attached myself to any kind of crime show, with the possible exception of Law and Order, which I used to watch religiously because it was on like 700 times a day, so I could record three or four episodes and then watch them all in one sitting at night. And going back way farther, way back, I'm a huge fan of Miami Vice. I love that show, and I even, on my blog, I write about various and sundry different things.
Weren't they supposed to do a movie about that recently?
They did
I heard
do a movie.
That they're going to try.
It was good.
Yeah, okay.
They did do a movie. They did it with Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx, and it was excellent.
That's right. I knew there was something. I've never seen it. Because elementary school or middle school, I think, when that came out.
Yeah.
Early 80s.
You're probably about the same age as I am.
Yeah, I'm 42, so somebody around that.
Yeah, I am as well. So we hit the same time. I mean, I loved that show when I watched it, and it made such an impact on me from a storytelling standpoint that to this day, my wife says to me, "Is this going to be another Miami Vice ending?" When I've given her something to read, because on Miami Vice, most of the time the killers or the drug dealers or whoever happened to be the bad guy that week would get away.
Right.
They would, justice was never served. And I've kind of subsumed that into my own writing. And it's like, I'm not going to give you the kind of ending you want. I'm going to give you the ending you deserve. And that may not be a happy ending.
Right.
But that's the way it's going to end.
You know, in real life, I mean, let's face it, they only catch 27% of all murders. So more often than not, the bad guy does get away.
Well, I'll add something to that. In Mexico, the chance of a murder being successfully prosecuted is less than
1%. Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah, yeah. That's something they'll never find. So that's the thing. You know, that's the fact of what's going on is simply there's just not a lot of, you know, they just don't solve as many as what people seem to think that they do. So that, you know, that's good that you're writing about that one.
Well, I had some contact with a guy named Robert Andrew Powell, and he has a book called I can't remember the name of the title off the top of my head. But he actually lived in Ciudad Juarez during the worst of it because he was following Juarez's soccer team, the Indios. And he and I were arguing back and forth because he had read my book. And he said, "I don't understand why in your book the cops are trying so hard to solve this murder because they don't do that in real life." And my thing was, yeah, that's true. They don't really do a very good job of that. But would you want to read a book where the cops don't do anything at all? They just say, "Well, another person murdered." Well, you know, you've got to
put that in the cold case file already.
another dead person. Let's shelve that and move on to the next killing, which you can almost understand because at the very worst of it, they were killing like 10 people a day. And I mean,
I live in California. You know, we live in Southern California, Los Angeles, so we kind of, and you're in Texas, so we both kind of have the same, you know, dynamic of where people in the north, northeast and whatnot, you're not so close to the fact of, are these cartels, you know, because they creep into the bigger cities, San Diego, Los Angeles, El Paso, San Antonio, places like that. There's a real scare down there, Phoenix.
Yeah, it's interesting, and one of the things that I talk about in Tequila Sunset for those people who want to rush right out and get that next month, El Paso was actually named the safest city in the United States because of its crime rate is so low.
Wow, I didn't know that one either.
Yeah, but 300 yards away is the second biggest murder capital in the world. Just it used to be number one, but now it's the second most violent city in the world, which is still nothing to sneeze at.
Oh, well, they're solving the problem then.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of people say in Mexico, they say that one of the reasons of the crime rate is the murder rate is going down is because they've killed each other too much.
Right.
They're running out of people to kill. And that there may be some truth to that because they were really killing each other a lot for a while there.
Well, you know, the fascination of all that interests me, and I do follow it because of where I live. And Mexico is definitely a country that I would love to visit because it has so much history and so many things that they have down there for tourists and, you know, the weather. And I think that the people generally are just very nice. So I really hope that something happens to where, you know, it can be more of a tourist attraction again, and we can cross over to the border into Tijuana and Baja and kind of go down and see things without the threat of being kidnapped and sold off into slavery or, you know, killed over, you know, in the middle of a drug fight or anything else like that. So I hope that that does happen someday.
Yeah, I mean, Mexico is a really great country, and it doesn't come off particularly well in the dead women because I'm talking about an issue that's endemic to that city. And I talk about police corruption, and I talk about violence in the justice system as well as on the street. And some people could be really turned off by that. One person said, "Well, you better not go down to Juarez again because the police are going to get you for what you wrote." And I'm like, well, that's entirely possible, but it's not unfair. The things that are going on, that's exactly what's happening. So you can't really blame me for it. But, yeah, the overwhelming majority of the Mexican people great people, hardworking, friendly, law-abiding. All they want to do is take care of their families, make a little money, live in a decent life. But you have this hardcore of incredibly violent people that have basically given the entire country a bad name because they'll kill anyone for any reason.
Right, right. Well, I'll tell you what, Sam, we want to thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about your couple books that you have here, Tequila Sunset coming out in ebook form in the U.S., and then The Dead Women of Juarez, the book coming out to the U.S. here in ebook and in hard copy form so people can go pick that up everywhere. We want to thank you so much for coming on, and, you know, we invite you back when you have some other stuff that you're writing into the future.
Well, next year there is another one coming. I did sell another one to Serpent Sale just a couple of months ago that's also set in Mexico, but not in Ciudad Juarez. It's set in Nuevo Laredo.
Well, let's get together, and we'll get you back on, and we'll talk about that one.
Great. Sounds good. Thank you for having
me.
All
right, Sam. Well, you have a good time, and enjoy yourself. Enjoy your weekend, and we will talk with you later.
All right. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is author Sam Hawken, and his latest book coming out here to the U.S., The Dead Women of Juarez, is available wherever you want to find them. And then Tequila Sunset is going to be available here in November, ebook form only in the U.S. You can pick that up, too. We want to thank all of our guests. We had John Connolly on here at the beginning. And again, there is something about John Connolly's interview that you're going to find intriguing. Follow us on Facebook. We will post a question that he answered, and you will have the opportunity to win a free autographed copy of his book, The Wrath of Angels. We also want to thank Sandra Parshall for coming on to talk about her book, Bleeding Through, and now Sam Hawken to talk about his, and that's samhawken.com. November here is rapidly, rapidly approaching, and our November issue is coming out very shortly. We are going to have that out probably the beginning of November, but then December we are going to have our awards of the best of 2012, and we're compiling that list now, so that is quite a monumental task that we have going on. Green Lake, our series is continuing. You can pick that up for free, everybody. Go to our website and you can find it for free. It's an ongoing, continuing series. We're going to also put it in audio form, playing it here on the radio for you to hear. And like I said, it's just going to be something free. You can follow it, do whatever you got to do, but it's very intriguing. We love writing it, myself and Donald Allen Kirch. And you can listen to his radio show, Stranger Than Fiction, on the Global Radio Alliance on Friday nights at midnight. And he will have the archived version up also. And go to DonaldAllenKirch.com and find out about his writing. So, again, we want to thank everybody for coming on. We are going to be back here on our next show. Check our website out in November with some really great guests coming on. So, the end of the year, we're going to have these sparingly shows, and then we'll ramp it back up again in January. So, until next time, everybody, good night, good morning, whenever you're listening. See you later.